accession number 27227, Reel 2.
Captain Hawk, Reel 2. So you were with Renowned for about
18 months.
So are we looking at now 1941, the tail end of 1941?
No, 1941 in about September. I did a year's course at Greenwich, the advanced engineering course, data engineering course.
What did that entail? What was
you done
before?
We did much more maths, and we considered all sorts of the more difficult problems, like vibration and so forth. It was an advanced engineering postgraduate course, mandatory. I must say that normally it was 2 years, and they cut it down to 1 year in the middle of the war. But even so, it was a very good value.
How did you? You say it was a good value, but how would you quantify that? What was the value that you?
Well, the first thing I learned how, some mathematics. I'd already done quite a bit of maths, but they did a lot of mathematics, and I must say that it's come in very useful ever since, and. We did a lot of metallurgy, and then particularly we had to design a turbine and a boiler.
So you had a lot of theory there. Were you able to apply that when you did join the ships?
Well, not really when you joined the ship, but I certainly applied it after the war, all right.
So you did a year there at Greenwich.
Yes.
What would that be, 41 into 42?
Yes, that's right.
What was the next drafting after Greenwich?
Warspite. Mm.
So where did you join Warspite?
I joined in Durban, actually. I might say I'd taken the ship out to Cape Town. We were shunted over to Durban, where she was up at Mombasa. I went up to Mombasa when she wasn't there. I came back in and got there, and then I got there in November in the end.
On your journey out there, had there been any U-boat scares on the ship you'd gone out in at all?
None at all. We went out in an enormous convoy. It was largely troops from the Far East.
And was it protected by...?
Cruisers and destroyers.
And when you joined Warspite, what was your initial impressions of her as a ship?
Well, I was slightly disappointed because Renown had been updated, actually. She had new machinery, and Warspite had original machinery.
What did that consist of that was different from Renown? What was there?
The turbines were more antique, and one of the most striking things in Milan, we had for the 15-inch guns, we had centrifugal pumps to discharge over 1,000 pounds square inch, but we had reciprocating machinery in Milan, in Warspite, and there was that.
She had a refit since the start of the war.
Oh, yes, she had a refit, all right. She got damaged in the Mediterranean in 1940 must have been, and she'd gone to the United States for a refit, and she was fairly well updated, but they hadn't touched the main machinery or anything of that sort.
How old were her turbines?
Well, she was built in... she went to sea in... 1915. Yes, that's right. 14 or 15.
And did the turbines date from that?
Yes.
So would they be reconditioned during that period?
Not really. I mean, well, how do you recondition a turbine? You don't. She'd had some things done to her.
Because at that stage, I think she'd seen quite a lot of action.
She had, yes. She'd seen quite a bit, yes.
Had that amount of service in wartime...
Well, she was damaged in off Crete, of course, and she had to go to America for action repairs.
And What had been repaired? Was there anything that was very noticeable?
Well, she had a bomb. She had been bombed on her 6-inch battery had a bomb and so forth. But it was all sort of mended.
And what were your initial duties on board Warspine?
Let me think now. I got it very soon. I became a damage control officer. I don't think I had any special. I think I must bring it straightforward into the damage control officer, actually. I was more senior by then.
And again, with Warspine, where was your accommodation on Warspine?
I had a cabin there.
Was that one that you could use at sea?
Yeah, I could use it at sea, yes.
Where was that located within the ship?
Right down aft, actually, but it was all right.
Did you have to share that one at all? Or?
No, it was a small cabin.
And what about your meals? Where would you take your meals?
In the officer's mess.
Were there more than one officer's mess on the ship?
Well, the warrant officer's mess and the officer's mess, yes. The warrant officer was an officer in those days.
And what type of food would you get on board?
Ordinary, everyday food. I mean, it was all right. When we were based in off the Africa, there were no potatoes. We had to make do with sweet potatoes, and the troops didn't like that at all.
You said there must have been mutiny amongst the seamen.
There was nothing to be done about it, but there it was.
And where did you sail to from Durban? Well,
the first thing we did was to escort Queen Mary, who was at that time they were evacuating the Australians from the Western Desert, and there was a big convoy which was going to Australia from there, and we covered that, and that was really about all there.
You were escorting the Queen Mary. Now, obviously, the Queen Mary was quite a fast ship. What was the kind of speed that Warspine could make?
23 knots.
Is that fast for a warship, or...?
No, it's slow, really. But she was an old ship.
What could the Queen Mary do?
That's 30 knots.
Was that fast enough to outrun U-boats?
It was, really. She was fairly safe. I don't think there's much danger of U-boats in the middle of the Indian Ocean there. The Japanese have been awfully lucky to have found her.
And you were escorting the Queen Mary with all these troops back to Australia, were you?
Yes, that's right. I never saw them, but we were there.
And obviously you're getting to know Warspine as a ship.
Yes.
How did you feel about that? Because obviously you said she wasn't as modern as Ringham, but what was she like as a ship?
Oh, she was all right. She was fine. She had eight 15-inch guns, of course.
Did she have good anti-aircraft cover again?
No. I would say firmly no. She had a 4-inch Mark 19, if you know them. They're useless.
And what makes them different from the... Are they different from the pom-pom guns?
Oh, yes. No, they had pom-poms, of course. But that was a fairly useless gun. It's muzzle also. It's only just over 2,000 feet per second, that pom-pom. We had, on the whole, rather useless anti-aircraft guns during the war. I appreciated this when I saw the American stuff.
So what was the aim with them, really, with the anti-aircraft guns? Was it really to put up a barrage and dissuade them?
I think so, yes.
You
really relied upon the aircraft carrier for defence.
So you were running these Australians back to Australia. Where were you disembarking them?
Well, we didn't go to Australia. We left them somewhere in the middle of the Indian Ocean and went back to Durban. Then we came home. To England, and we had a brief refit in Rosyth Dockyard.
What did that entail?
Well, it was really just sort of making good the various defects we had. We got a lot more small guns, Oerlikons and so forth, but not anything really much.
Was there anything, you know, you mentioned the vibration problem, obviously, with the
There's nothing to be done about that. It was known after the war, actually. I was in the engineering chief's department, and they really got down to exactly what was happening with that actual vibration, and we understood it. It made sense what they said. We knew how to cure it or alleviate it, and we done the drill, that's it.
How did you alleviate it?
And just by easing up on the shaft.
That was all that it was that would do that.
Yeah.
Initially, when that problem had occurred, was it understood what it was, or was it a shock that that kind of vibration occurred? Because it must have occurred quite early on in the
ship. It did. They'd always had that trouble. Most of the big warships at that time had the trouble because they didn't appreciate it. It wasn't until really after the war that we got that one nicked.
I suppose with something that large, there's no actual way of knowing until you've built it and tried it how it would perform anyway.
Well, there is now, because you designed for it, but it was a fact that wasn't in the counting design.
Because I suppose in 1914-15, when she was first commissioned, they wouldn't have known that, though, would they?
No, they wouldn't.
They would just build. They would just build a bit larger and larger ship.
Yes, right. Yes.
And assumed it would perform in the same way.
I think so. Yes.
So with the refit, where was the next move?
To the Mediterranean. By that time, Rommel had been finished with, but the next thing on the program was, of course, Italy or Sicily. We went to Alexandria, and then we covered the landings in Sicily. We did counter bombardments.
Is there anything memorable about the bombardments that you conducted on Sicily?
No, I don't think so particularly. We given targets and we just bombarded them. But by that time, of course, a battleship was no use, no surface ships to oppose. We 15-inch guns were used entirely for shore bombardment.
Was it becoming noticeable that the battleship was in many respects becoming obsolete?
I think so. I think this is true. All the carrier had taken over from it, yes.
Were you aware of that you were doing?
Oh, yes. I appreciate the importance of the carrier.
Would you say that was the case amongst, say, your brother officers? Or were the people who still hung on to the idea of the battleship as a...
Well, I don't think... I think we bowed to the inevitable. We realised that we were fighting the wrong war against other ships.
As a shore bombardment tool, though, was the war fighter useful?
I think very useful. It was larger, of course, the main size of the shell, so it weighed a ton. And they were, of course, not arm-piercing shells, they were high-explosive shells. And we sort of got less and less arm-piercing shells amongst us and carried more and more high-explosive.
And how far could she throw the shells?
Well, about 23 miles, if you want to. We didn't bombard that kind of range, I don't think. We bombarded about, at Salerno we were bombarding about 10 miles ahead.
So how would you know how successful you've been with your...
Well, the answer is we put a Royal Marine officer went ashore, and he was sort of lying in the mud and seeing what was happening. And we were bombarding from a position only about a mile offshore, and at a position about 10 or 11 miles inland. Forward officer, he got the shells landing about half a mile in front of him. So I assume it's been rather frightening.
Would he be the person who would choose the targets for the ship?
I think the army requested the targets basically, but he did all the fire control for the. Well, he did the spotting side of it. which had to be interpreted in the ship.
And how effective would a salvo from Warspite be on a position, would you say?
We tended not to bombard broadsides. We tended to do salvo firing, which was about four guns at a time, and then another four.
And again, once the guns were firing, is there any effect on the ship?
You can feel the recoil of the ship, the 15-inch guns, you can feel their recoil, all right. But, no.
I mean, because I've heard sometimes that there was damage to more sort of signals equipment or radar equipment during bombardments, more delicate type of
thing. Yes, there was. You had really to be rather careful what angle you were firing at. It's quite true there was some trouble with that. But one learned. And after all, you could maneuver the ship, and you tend to fire on your beam when you're bombarding.
And would you have had any dealings with that side of things, the ship's radar or the signals equipment at all in your role?
No, not at that stage. Later on, after the war, I did.
So obviously, you're on board Warspite when Warspite was hit.
Yes, I was.
Could you take me through in step by step in as much detail as possible?
Yes, well, what happened, we'd just done a bombardment and we're leaving, and I don't know how fast we're going, probably about 10 or 12 knots, not terribly fast, because we're absolutely littered with small craft and so forth there. And I'm not a witness to what happened, but what happened, by account, was there was an attack by Fort Wolfs against the ship, which occupied the anti-aircraft gunnery very thoroughly and resulted in absolutely nothing. But at the same time, about 20,000 feet, Heinko came over with a radio-controlled bomb, which weighed about 2 tons, I believe, and it dropped this, and it was one of the earliest guided weapons, and they guided down and hit us. They previously, a few days earlier, sunk the Roma, the Italian battleship, with the same weapon, and in that case, they hit a magazine, she just blew up. But in our case, they didn't hit a magazine, so we didn't blow up.
Can you explain to me in as much detail again as possible what damage did occur to the ship?
We only knew of one hit at the time, it came down, went through the hangar, straight down through the Stokes Mess deck, and it actually hit the superheater on the boiler, and exploded, blowing out the bottom of the ship. Actually, there was a great hole, about 15 or 20 feet across, which let the water in, putting it mildly, that flooded up that boiler room, and the one next door to there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and it hit number 4 boiler room, it flooded the one abreast it, and it flooded the one off it right away. They both only just sort of got out in time. We were running properly in units, so we lost steam in half the machinery straight off, so the turbo generators went off. I remember sitting in the hearing the bombs hit in the damage control headquarters, and I remember the diesels started up as they should have done absolutely right away. I felt, please, at least one thing's gone right. After that, they in number 5 boiler room, they flooded up fairly quickly. Number 5, they very nearly managed to get the. They had some turbo pumps in the boiler rooms, which were supposed to pump out large volumes of water, and they just about got it going, but they couldn't make it. And in the end, they're defeated and had to retreat up the steps. Then that left really only one boiler on, one boiler room was still running, with two turbo generators hanging on it actually. But they went for about half or three quarters of an hour on number one boiler, and then they got water in their fuel. I'm not surprised actually, and that shut them down, and we lost all power, all steam power. The diesel was still running, of course, and when we were in tow, we just had our diesels to electric light, and that was it. For about an hour, I was in Damstraw headquarters, and we were sort of taking note of all the messages that came in. And the stoker was supposed to write down what happened. What was happening? It was just too much for him, and he couldn't cope. But he did his best, and it took an awful lot of trouble to sort out afterwards the timing of everything. But there it was. What we knew at that stage was that we'd been hit in the number four boiler room. The bomb only killed 12 people, which is extraordinary, actually. It killed three in the boiler room, three in the hangar, and about six on the stoker, smith stoker, and that was a lot. And no wounded. They were hit by the thing coming down, or they were not hit.
And you say you were in the damage control headquarters assessing the situation.
Yeah.
How were you receiving the information?
Oh, by telephone.
Was the telephone system connected throughout the ship?
Yes, but there was a direct sound power phones to all the positions. There was no trouble about communications.
And who were you relying on the information for?
The damage control parties. There were four of them as previously, and they just sent in their messages. After about an hour, things had quietened down. There was obviously nothing more to actually do. I got somebody else to take over Downshore headquarters, and I went out to see what had happened. There wasn't very much I could see. I could look at, shall I say, rather than see. The boilers were obviously flooded, and you could see that. So they came up. You could look at the uptakes, and you could see the water. I went to look at the shaft passages. I read it was one of the places I could go to, and there was absolutely. First of all, there was no lights. I had to use a torch, and the usual way the torch was one of the ones they issued to them, which were absolutely useless. You had to keep taking it to pieces and putting it together again. Anyway, we weren't plugged in shafts at all, and the engine rooms were there, but I mean they were absolutely dead. There's nothing done. The turbo generators weren't working, rather obviously, and that was about it.
You mentioned at one stage that the number one boiler room kept going.
Yeah.
Was that enough, just one boiler, to power the ship?
No, not really to power the ship. The thing that we were after was the turbo generators. We could have powered the ship, but not really, so you noticed. But we lost our turbo generators, which was a loss, actually.
And you said there'd been a large hole blown in the bottom of the ship.
Yeah. We didn't know anything about this time, of course.
I was going to say, what do you do when that happens? Did you just, were the boiler rooms then just sealed and made watertight?
Yes.
Or were they watertight?
They were watertight. The bulkheads, of course, came up to quite a long way. There was no question of getting free surface on top of the thing or anything of that sort.
Was there no way you could have examined what damage had occurred at that? There's no way of knowing what damage had occurred at that stage.
No, none at all. Anyway, that was really about all that happened that day. The next day, the fleet constructor officer came on board and looked at us. One rather odd thing struck me was that we knew we got five boiler rooms flooded. Number one boiler room wasn't flooded at all. We kept water out of that. We had a list about 4 degrees to starboard, whereas we had expected that we'd had a list about 1 degree to port, because the boilers are about near the centre line, and there was one boiler room not flooded and five flooded, and so we'd expected a list to port. That baffled me, actually, but I watched carefully. We had an inclinometer to tell us what the heel of the ship was, but it wasn't increasing, so I reckon there wasn't any more water coming into the ship. So that was about all you could do with it.
And what was the role of the fleet construction officer?
Well, he came along to find what the situation was. We discussed the stability of the ship, which was no problem, actually. I produced I had the cards with all the information on, and we sort of discussed that, but there was no problem there. We no suggestion why we got a list to starboard. But he, in the end, recommended we should flood the... had some bulges on the port side to bring us level. I was rather doubtful about this because, after all, we were doing no harm in having the four degrees of list. And once we'd applied those bulges, there was no way of pumping them out again without docking with the boiler rooms flooded. You couldn't get at them. I think he was really worrying about the amount of water we were drawing, getting into Malta Harbour, which I realised in the end, and so we were level when we came into Malta.
In that first 24 hours, once the list had gone, what was booked, were you the ship relatively stable at that point? Did it not change? Or
no, it didn't change at all, no. No, we an American tug took us in tow and started towing us back to Malta. I believe we came past Scylla and Charybdis broadside on, but I wasn't up on deck, so I had to see that.
And did you have more time to inspect later on at all, as you were going towards Malta?
No, there wasn't anything you could look at. There's nothing to look at. We knew what was flooded. It was the boiler rooms, and really that was all, as far as we could see.
Were you escorted as you made your way back?
No, I don't think so. Everybody was too busy ashore. Nobody's going to attack us there.
When the ship got back to Malta, what was the next thing that happened then?
We decided we'd get number one boiler room working properly, and we had some trouble with the... in order to run the turbo generators, we could run two turbo generators off that. We could run more if we want to. We knew they couldn't dock us at Malta, by the way. We were drawing too much water. In any case, we didn't want to because we're obviously a long-term business and there was plenty of short-term. So Savannah had been hit by one of these things as well, the USS Savannah. Arranged to steam so that number one boiler room could steam, and we had to get the steam exhaust from there to the engine rooms, and we had to put a pipe along the mast and so forth, and that was all right, no trouble. We were towed back to Edenminster's Jib, where we docked. And when we docked down, we saw what a mess, and we saw why we had a starboard list. There had been another explosion along on our starboard side, which had blown in the actual bulge itself and flooded some bulges on the starboard side. And that accounted for that very nicely.
Explained what the problem was.
Yes, well, we couldn't have known what it was beforehand.
I suppose you felt happier then, knowing that there was some reason for that.
Well, yes, it was explained, yes.